Welcome to Indie Audio, the audio version of The Independent. To listen to past episodes of Indie Audio and of the podcast Indestructible, go to independent.org. That's independent.org. If you like what you hear, please help support The Independent by going to our webpage and donating or becoming a subscriber.
My name is Erin Sheridan, and I wrote the article One Woman's Struggle in the July issue of The Independent. In late 2005, Anna, a Honduran woman in her mid-20s, stood looking at the rubber rim of a tire on the edge of the Rio Grande, just across from the U.S. border. The smuggler she had paid to escort her and her 5-year-old son from Tegucigalpa had just asked her to take her clothes off. Wary of getting undressed in front of a stranger, she refused. The coyote responded, then, "You're going to get wet." "Okay, then I will get wet," she said to him before lying down on the tire with her son, Michael, in her arms. The man stripped down, climbed into the water, and pulled the two across the flowing river and into the United States. 13 years later, Anna, a pseudonym she requested for fear of retaliation, now 39, is still undocumented, but has 2 U.S.-born daughters who are citizens. She has seen her husband, Juan, deported once, which got her and the children evicted, leaving them homeless, and detained 3 times, most recently for 5 months earlier this year. Michael, now 19, is allowed to stay temporarily under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. When we spoke this spring, he was supporting the entire family, running his father's beverage delivery business while his father was locked up. Anna remembers the silence on the bank of the Rio Grande that day in 2005. It was 2 p.m. There were no helicopters, no border patrol agents ready to place her under arrest. "I thought, they have to know that people are passing," she recalls. The coyote instructed her to walk towards a U.S. Customs and Border Patrol outpost. There, she surrendered to an agent who drove her to an office, sat her down in an air-conditioned room, and stared into her eyes for 1/4 hour without speaking. He told me, "You are so seen for Wenza. You have no shame. You should be ashamed of yourself," he told me in Spanish. He said, "How did you come here? Why are you here? And you had the audacity to bring this little boy here." Eventually, a female agent walked in, asked to take over the case, and began asking Anna routine questions. She was taken to a shelter with her son, put on a bus with $60, and sent to meet Juan, who had arrived several months prior. She did not speak English. Had Anna crossed into the United States in 2018, she and her son would likely have been separated. In April, the Trump administration decided it would prosecute all people crossing the border without visas on criminal charges instead of civil charges and jail them if they did not return immediately. Their children, who could not legally be detained in adult jails, were held in separate facilities if they were not claimed by someone who could prove they were a relative. In Honduras, Anna and her husband had managed to get by. She worked 3 jobs and Juan ran his own business. But life in Tegucigalpa got increasingly dangerous as gang violence escalated. Gang members gave Anna's brother-in-law, a police officer, a beating as a warning. The family began receiving death threats. "Over there, in the neighborhood that we are from, you can't wear your preference of the sport team you like if the gang is against it," she says. "You can't wear some types of shoes if they don't like it. It's horrible." The couple moved to Costa Rica after the birth of their daughter, but left after she died. They were too devastated to focus on running their business, so they returned to Honduras, where the threats began again. "We couldn't make it anymore. We didn't realize," Anna says. "And we weren't paying attention to our son. He was staying with my mother-in-law. We realized we were depressed. That's why we decided to come." In the United States, the couple had another daughter, now 10, but Anna and the children became homeless after Juan was seized by immigration agents in 2009. "The next day, my landlord came up and told me, 'You have to leave the apartment because you won't be able to pay,'" she says. "My husband had just paid rent recently. I got so scared and my husband was telling me, 'You have to get out of there because they are going to come and get you.' I found myself with my children outside in the snow, at night, so I went to the train." Juan was deported to Honduras. He left Anna an emergency fund, which she gave to the pastor at her church for safekeeping. She went back to work as a housekeeper and took refuge with the children in a city shelter. Juan got more death threats in Honduras, so he spent the family savings hiring a coyote to come back to the United States. "After my husband came, we left the shelter and we started again," Anna says. But in 2013, Juan was detained for a second time. His lawyer was able to get him released on humanitarian grounds with an order of supervision. That meant he had to check in with Immigration and Customs Enforcement every 6 months. After Donald Trump became president, their lawyer warned that Juan was likely to be deported. "I started to get anxiety, real anxiety," Anna says. "My husband started to work more. He was getting skinny. His eyes were really red because all he did was work. You know why? Because he wanted to save money. He was thinking, 'If something happens to me, I want to help my family.' He didn't want us to be homeless like before." In January, Juan was arrested by ICE when he checked in. He was detained at the Hudson County Correctional Facility in Kearney, New Jersey, one of the 3 major ICE-maintained detention centers in the state. The Hudson County Jail has housed detained immigrants since the mid-1990s. A 2016 report by Detention Watch documented an overall poor quality of life, as well as a lack of adequate access to medical care and legal assistance. It costs prisoners around $1 to make a phone call for 18 to 19 minutes. If Juan needs extra food, clothes, or toiletries, Anna has to either buy them through the jail commissary or send him money. Juan got a job inside the jail cleaning bathrooms, but quit after he was paid only $1 a day. Michael has put off plans to go to college. He has taken over Juan's beverage delivery business and is working 17-hour days to support the family. He says, "Mommy, my father hasn't done nothing bad." He repeats that a lot. He told me 3 days ago, "I can't. I'm tired. This is so hard." On the evening of Juan's arrest, Anna told her two young daughters that he had driven to another state to visit a friend. Her 10-year-old, however, quickly caught on. Several days later, she asked Anna if she was getting a divorce. "I thought, oh my God, this is the time," recalls Anna. "I said, you remember when Papi was going to that big office downtown? Because one day he came and waited. He went inside and he came out with his permit when he was under that order of supervision." And she said, "Oh, so you mean that when Trump came in, he made that order and he changed it?" She's a very articulate and strong 10-year-old, and when she speaks, she looks into your eyes. "I hate him," she says. "Why is he doing that? That's not fair." Anna's younger daughter, 5 years old, doesn't understand why her father is absent. Sometimes she tells me, "Give me my papi," and I tell her that he's going to come soon. I don't know if she feels that it's because of me he's not here. Anna recently graduated from community college with honors. She was ineligible for financial aid because she's undocumented, but the school gave her scholarships to help her finish. She also couldn't complete an internship at a local hospital because she does not have a social security number. Michael has expressed interest in studying business. Anna hopes to continue her education to become a nutritionist and get an MS and PhD. In summer, what I'm planning to do is buy the books for microbiology and another sort of biology class to start to read and learn the material and do something in my free time. If I've got some, she says. But she needs financial aid, and the family's economic status depends on whether Juan can stay in the United States. He was released from detention in early June, but his future is uncertain. "Sometimes I feel so depressed, but then I remind myself that I'm fortunate as a mother, as a student, as a wife," Anna says. "I can't give up, because if I give up, my whole family falls. It's a lot of pressure. If you ask me, my health is really, really bad. It's important to speak up about what's happening and how we suffer so that maybe people can understand the realities of our community," she continues. "We can't stay quiet, we can't stop moving, we have to move, we have to do something. That's why I decided to tell my story." Note: shortly before the indie went to press, Anna's husband Juan was released from detention but will have to reappear in court. He returned to work the next day. Their son Michael will be able to attend his first semester of college. Her husband went to check-ins. She got her order to appear in court when she first came here 13 years ago, and she was like, "I'm not going to go. I can't go home. I'm not going to go."
Right.
So she's just been hiding for 13 years. But she was not really worried about herself for whatever reason. She was more worried about her husband because he had had a... He had been previously deported and re-entered, which is why he was up for deportation when Trump got elected, when he signed that executive order.
Why was he up for deportation?
They made it a rule that if you have a re-entry on your record, you are eligible to be picked up by ICE, detained, and deported. And then, obviously, the Trump administration also went after DACA, which means that her 19-year-old son, who really doesn't remember Honduras, would be sent back.
Right.
And her two daughters are American citizens, so it would be... They don't know Honduras. They're all fluent Spanish speakers. She's made a point to do that in their home, so they would be fine if they went back.
In terms of language.
In terms of language, terms of getting... But in terms of getting by, I mean, she says there's really no work in Honduras on top of the actual threat of violence to her and her family because of their connections to the police, so...
So what do you think their next moves are going to be?
It's a huge mess. And actually, this family was very lucky to have the money to be able to hire a good lawyer to get him out this time.
Mm-hmm.
She says when he got detained, for the third time this year, she went around to all the nonprofits first. They all were like, "We can't take your case." They're all the, like, all the pro bono attorneys are overwhelmed, I'm certain.
They have enough on their end.
Yeah, and then it's sort of like when you think you have a medical problem and you're trying to find a doctor who will take you seriously.
Right.
So she's had to navigate that whole system by herself. She says she feels like a lawyer at this point.
She's an expert.
Yeah, and they're lucky that her husband has
worked so diligently at his business, and they had a fund saved up and were able to, they again had to spend their savings on a good lawyer to get him out so that he could work. And right. So the next step really is, now that things are stable for the time being, is that they just keep going. The son goes to school. She wants to continue her education. And they just keep on marching on.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you would like depict from like observing from being in close contact and attending the Judson meetings of New Sanctuary Coalition, Judson, and talking to these families? Like, is there anything that you think people don't talk about enough, or things that you observe just from being there that's not really portrayed?
There are very real, massive, inappropriate, horrific attacks happening on immigrant members of our communities across the country right now, but I think that what gets lost is that there really are people within these communities who are willing to put in the work to fight for them. Mm. We see that in New York with the work the New Sanctuary Coalition does is amazing. It's like, I feel like the human faces get lost on both sides of this.
On both sides?
Yeah, down in these communities, when you get involved in these organizations, you really see that there are people who give a damn that we allow immigrants in, that we allow people a path to citizenship and a decent life. And then you see that the people who are coming here are just like, they have no bad intentions whatsoever. Like, these people are just, they're trying to survive. They were depressed at home. There's no economic opportunity. It's millions of stories and circumstances that you can't possibly understand unless you sit down and talk to people about why they're here. At a certain point, I think it becomes besides the point why people are here, you know? Mm. They're just... People have been moving around for as long as people have been a thing.
That was The Indie Audio, the audio version of The Independent, produced by Elia Grant.